Hello and welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about the poem Judith and the Old English word hoard. That's hoard, H-O-R-D. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Hannah Vidine, the author of The Word Hoard, Daily Life in Old English, published recently by Princeton University Press. Based in Toronto, she is well known for her Twitter account at OE Word Hoard. That's OE for Old English Word Hoard, H-O-R-D. She joins us by Skype as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Hannah, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Why is the Old English poem Judith a great book?
It's a little tricky since it's not actually a book. A book in the medieval period is quite different from what we think of as a book today. Often it doesn't have an author and it could be a collection of random texts. So each book was different. It was would have been handwritten by different scribes who copied the text from some other place and might make changes to it intentionally or by mistake. So part of the reason I chose Judith is because it's actually in the same book as Beowulf. The book itself is called the Beowulf Manuscript, or sometimes the Noel Codex, and it was made around the year 1000. And I think when we think of Old English today, we often think of Beowulf, and Judith is one poem that I think is also really great to discuss and read that isn't covered as much. So that's why I chose Judith today.
We're going to talk about Judith. We'll talk a little bit about Beowulf, the best poems from Old English, some lesser-known works, plus the language of Old English itself. What was it? How did it evolve into modern English, and a lot more? Let's start with this poem, this text called Judith. Hannah, introduce it for us. What is this work, and who is Judith?
So Judith is a poem of about 350 lines about a really badass heroine whose wit and bravery save her people in what seems like a hopeless battle. It describes Judith's righteous slaying of Holofernes with God's aid and the subsequent rout of the Assyrian army by Hebrew troops. And it's based on the story as it's told in the book of Judith from the Old Testament.
All right, let me pause you there. The book of Judith is a part of the Old Testament, but what is its status in the Bible? It's a disputed text.
Yes, it's what's called a deuterocanonical text. So there are seven deuterocanonical books. They're missing from most non-Catholic Bibles. So the book of Judith was regarded as canonical in early medieval England. However, now it would not be considered so by most Protestant denominations. The deuterocanonical texts, like deuterocanonical itself, literally means of the second canon. So it was a canon of scripture that was accepted by the church later on than the first canon. And these texts are generally from the period of around 300 BCE to 100 CE, so around the time before there was a definite sort of division between the Christian church from Judaism.
So the book of Judith in the Bible, or out of it, is the inspiration for this poem, clearly.
Yes.
And so what happens in the poem? Is it a faithful adaptation, or does it involve its own kind of creativity?
Well, one of the reasons why I love the poem is because it is quite creative. It elaborates on mainly on the heroic elements of the biblical version, sort of amplifying the heroic story and using the language and topoi of a Germanic epic poem. So, for instance, it contains a full-scale battle scene and seems to take particular relish in sort of describing the decapitation of Holofernes. It depicts Judith much more as a heroine of noble ancestry who is a leader of her people in battle, as opposed to the biblical Judith, who has more emphasis put on her status as a chaste widow. She doesn't receive the same treatment.
they're both great and heroic characters, but this the Judith of the Old English poem is quite different, as you say. How about Holofernes, our villain? Who is this guy?
So Holofernes is the wicked general that is the leader of the Assyrians, who have had Bethulia, the city of the Hebrews, under siege. He's supposed to destroy them. And he has way more men than the Hebrews do, so it looks very uncertain that they will have a chance at surviving. One of the other changes from the scripture to the poem is the poem makes him out to be, I think, more evil than the scripture. I think the poet is trying to really divide the good and the evil clearly, this sort of binary in the story. So Judith is portrayed as more heroic, and Holofernes is portrayed more clearly a villain. So he threatens Judith, and he's portrayed as a lech and a bad leader, which isn't something that comes across in the scripture.
And Judith then takes extreme action against him.
Yes. And that aspect of the story is the same in the story, both in the scripture and in the poem. She manages to take Holofernes' own sword and chop off his head. And then she puts the head in a bag and leaves with her handmaid. They return to the Hebrew camp. And when the Hebrews see that she has killed Holofernes and brought his head, they're given sort of new inspiration and encouragement to win the battle.
Hannah, when was Judith written, roughly? Why do you think it might have resonated with readers or listeners back then?
Well, we don't know exactly when Judith would have been composed, since the Noel Codex, or the Beowulf manuscript itself, was written around the year 1000, but it could have been that the texts were composed earlier or even recorded in earlier manuscripts. But the manuscript that we have is from around the year 1000, so it's about 1000 years old. And I think it would have resonated in some interesting ways with 10th century English people. Even though the population would have been Christian, and this is a poem that is about a Jewish heroine, which is sort of interesting. I think the way she's portrayed in the poem as a great leader of her people who saves them from sort of powerful enemies, powerful invaders, might have resonated given sort of the English experience with Viking raids and having to face off with forces that seemed sort of beyond their capability to meet in battle. And so I think that aspect of the poem would have been really, really something inspiring to people of the time.
The text of Judith, as it survives, you mentioned it's 300-some lines of poetry, but it's incomplete. There's a part of it missing.
Right. So it's interesting. We can see that part of it is missing because the poem is actually numbered in sections, which are called fits. And the fits start well into the poem. I think the first one is fit 9. So we know that there's some preceding poetry that is missing. We don't know how much. If we compare it to the Book of Judith in the Vulgate Bible, it corresponds to chapter 12, verse 10 to chapter 16, verse 1. And the Book of Judith has 16 chapters total. So we're looking at 12, almost 13 chapters of the story missing. That said, those preceding chapters are not all about Judith. There's some background information about what's going on with Nebuchadnezzar and why Holofernes is going out to kill all these people. So I don't know how much of that would have been included in the poem, or if any of it would have been included in the poem. We don't really know. It's possible that there was more to the poem ahead of it that was not even related to the Judith story, because what's important to remember is the title of the poem that we give it, Judith. That's a title that modern scholars gave to a poem that was already incomplete. And so we don't know what the full scope of the poem might have been. But I think as a poem, it works really well, even though it has a section of it obviously missing. You begin in medias res, so it's got, you know, the Judith is briefly introduced, but it gets right into the action of the poem where she's at the Assyrian camp. So I think even though it's incomplete, it works quite well.
Can you give us a taste of the language? We call it Old English, but it's actually a foreign language to us speakers of modern English, isn't it?
Yeah, it does sound quite different. I've got a little passage here about Judith actually killing Holofernes that I could read for you. It happens around line 103 of the poem.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Slo tha wooden lock, thona feon shiadon, fagum meche, hete thon kulna, that hail hailvna for cherv, thona swear on him, that he on swimmen lie, drunken und dolhund, nas tha dead tha yit, eles orsaula, slo tha ernoste, ides elen rof, othra side, thona hathenen hund, that him that havered wand, forth on the flora. So that section, in translation, would be, the flowing-haired one struck that injurious foe with the gleaming sword, the hostile-minded one, so that she cut through half his neck, so that he lay in a stupor, drunk and mutilated. He was not dead yet, completely lifeless. Then the woman of daring resolutely struck the heathen hound another time, so that his head rolled forward onto the floor.
Okay, I have so many questions. That sounds nothing like modern English, you know, the old English bit that you read, maybe very faintly mm-hmm. in some echoes of it we hear, but why do we even call it English when it's so incomprehensible to a modern day listener like me?
It's called English because it is the language that became our English, and some words of it would actually be easily recognizable to English speakers today. So what I read is poetry, which is the hardest kind of Old English for modern readers to translate. And that's because not only do you have some different vocabulary, but the meaning is you don't get meaning from syntax the way we do today. So when we have a sentence, we know where the subject and the object and the verb are because we have a particular word order. But in Old English, you didn't need to do that. You knew what purpose a word had in a sentence because of its ending. So it's called inflection rather than syntax, that from which you derive meaning. And for that reason, the words are in what seems like a really random order to us, and it has a lot of strange endings. But it's also true that many of the words are not used anymore. We no longer call a woman an Edess. That's not a word that survived. But there are other words that sound really similar, like hathen is heathen and hund is hound. And even the last bit of that part that I read was forth on the flora, which sounds pretty much the same as forth on the floor. So some of the words do sound very clearly English, even though overall it sounds very foreign.
Now give us a quick potted history, if you will, how we get from Old English, that language you just read to us, to Middle English, to Modern English. Give us a quick and dirty version. What happens?
Old English, we tend to date, roughly from 550 to 1150, which those are arbitrary start and end dates, but it's the range that's generally given. By 1150, you're seeing many more changes in grammar and vocabulary in the surviving texts. So we're moving from this inflected language into a more syntactical language. So that makes it a lot easier for us to read. And also borrowings from Latin and French and Norse are becoming more frequent. So the vocabulary is not just limited to Germanic words. A lot of those words are words that we continue to use today, the ones that came in from French. So it is a little bit more familiar to us. So Middle English, which is what comes next around 1150 or so, is what was used by Chaucer. It's what's used in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And it's pretty easy. Well, I shouldn't say pretty easy. It's a challenge to read, but it can be done like without too much trouble using, you know, a glossary. After the Middle Ages, sort of, it's around the time of the printing press that they that is sort of described as the date when early modern English begins, which is the kind of English that Shakespeare was using. And around that time, there was a lot of standardization happening because of the printing press. So spellings started to become set a certain way, and there were changes in pronunciation that were happening. But that, like Shakespeare, we can still understand today. So that's what we call early modern English, which then turns into modern English.
Hani, you gave us some words that endure. There are some words in Old English that endure, certainly endure in a way, in modern English. What does that tell us about our language?
I think it tells us, when we look at those words that have endured, it tells us that there's never been a time when we haven't needed that word. It's always been relevant and useful. For instance, the word word has stayed the same for over 1,000 years. It also tells us a bit about what words were affected by the Normans coming in. So when we see words that have been, we've left behind the Old English version for a more French version. For instance, there's the word dom, which means judgment in Old English. Now we use judgment, which is from French. And that's a word that is connected to law and sort of the ruling classes. So it makes sense in a way that when the Norman ruling class came in, the words that were related to law or to education or sort of government, that those words would change into French words. But words that have remained the same include a lot of our names for animals, for instance. So we have cat, hund, sheep, horse, swine, are quite similar to the words we use today. And in fact, the word book is also the same. So these are, I think, those are the concepts that we've always had around, we've always needed, and have always been very important in our lives.
Hani, you mentioned the word word as one that endures from Old English into modern English today. That's part of your book title. Your book is called The Word Hoard. You use that as one word. Word hoard is one word. W-O-R-D-H-O-R-D. Explain that title, The Word Hoard.
So word hoard is a word that appears only 7 times in extant Old English texts, but it's one of my favorite words. And it means literally a hoard of words, or sort of a store of words, your personal word storage. And it doesn't refer to a dictionary or a thesaurus like you might think maybe it would today. It reflects the fact that oral poetry was so important in this time, in the early medieval period. And a poet would recite their poems, and they would need a store of words to draw upon, so words and phrases. Because when you're trying to tell a story, it's helpful to have some of those just on hand in the back of your brain to pull out when you're trying to tell a story, particularly when you're trying to use alliteration, which was very important. So that's what a word hoard is. It's sort of your personal stockpile of words. And as I've been learning about Old English and studying Old English, and researching Old English, I've come across many words that I love for various reasons. And over the years, I've kind of created my own word hoard, so a collection of these words that I really love. And so that was the idea behind the book, is that I would share that. The compound word hoard appears frequently in Old English next to the verb onlookon, which is unlock. And I really liked this idea of unlocking the word hoard, which is what various people do in Old English poems. So they unlock their word hoard and share it with their audience. So that's why I called the book The Word Hoard.
And that's what the book does. It unlocks your word hoard. It describes all of these words from Old English. Some we recognize, some we don't. What they tell us about daily life for people in England 1,000 years ago, what we can glean from it now. I know you like this word, the word hoard. Do you have a very favorite word from Old English?
I would probably say word hoard is my favorite word, but there are other words that I also love, like sawldreor is one of my favorites. It means soul blood. And it's often translated lifeblood, but it's actually soul blood. And I like that idea that the soul is connected in some way with the blood. So another one I really like is hreadamus, which means bat, but it literally translates to adorned mouse, which I just love because it's a mouse adorned with wings. And that's just a really adorable word. And a lot of the words that I love are kennings, which are a kind of poetic compound that appears a lot in Old English poetry. And basically, it's two nouns that you put together that mean that when you put them together, make kind of a metaphor or riddle for something. So, for instance, sweilkandl means sky candle, and that's a kenning for the sun. So I really enjoy those as well.
When I first learned about Beowulf, I learned this idea of kennings, and I never learned to read Beowulf in the Old English. It was always in translation, but we learned about kennings and what they were, and the one I remember is whale road, and that was a term for a waterway or the sea. Connect us then with Beowulf here. This is the great granddaddy of Old English literature. It's in the same manuscript as the poem Judith, which we've been discussing. Why is Beowulf so famous? Why does it loom so large as this great product of Old English literature?
Well, it's the most substantial poetic text that survives in Old English by far. I mean, if you look at, for instance, Beowulf has over 3,000 lines of poetry in comparison to Judith's 350. And so it by far outstrips most Old English, well, all Old English poems. And for the most part, it's complete with a beginning, middle, and end, which, for example, Judith doesn't have. There's part of it missing. And there is a little bit of the text that is damaged beyond reading, but it's a relatively small portion. And it's just a fascinating poem. I think that's why we keep reading it. It's full of allusions to this vanished world of 6th century Scandinavia. And so it's kind of fascinating, actually, that we read this poem to learn about culture in early medieval England. So, you know, the time that I'm talking about is the 10th century or so. And the world depicted in this poem is already long ago and far away to the people writing it down. But it's fascinating. You can still see sort of what people who are using Old English, people who wrote it down, what was important to them at the time. And sort of you can see the influence of that later world on this early kind of mythical world.
Beowulf was show number 6 in this podcast series. We did it a long, long time ago. And if you're a member of NR Plus, you can download it and listen to it right now. Hannah, give us a sense of what else is out there. How many texts are there? What are the best of them? If Beowulf and then Judith are two of the great ones, what else is out there? What survives from a millennium ago?
I think David Crystal sums it up as being about 30 medium-length novels. That's kind of the length of, if we take all of the texts that we have in Old English, that's how much we have. So it is a relatively small amount when you're thinking about how many medium-length novels we have today, for instance. So it doesn't seem like a lot, but there's a whole lot of variety in there. We look at poetry mostly in literature classes, but we also have homilies, we have saints' lives, we have medical texts that describe different remedies for things, we have chronicles telling about the history, there's even charters and wills. So there's all kinds of different types of writing to look at. One of my favorite poems in Old English, well, I love Judith and I love Beowulf, but I also really like The Dream of the Rood, which is a poem in which the cross on which Christ was crucified is actually speaking to a dreamer, and it's sort of telling about its life from being selected as a tree in the forest and then coming to have this important role. I think I really like the fact that this cross is able to talk. I was thinking about what texts I most enjoy in Old English, it's funny because I realized I also really love the Exeter Book riddles, which are a series of nearly 100 riddles that were written in the 10th century. And I kind of like these for the same reason, in that these creatures and objects that normally don't get to talk get to talk in this case. They have a voice, so I quite enjoy those. Those riddles are really interesting to look at. Some of them are quite humorous, while others are more, you know, abstract and beautiful. And there aren't any solutions given to them. So scholars have all kinds of ideas on what the solution is to each of these riddles, but ultimately we don't know what the scribe had in mind for any of them.
How did you discover Old English, and why did it fascinate you so much that you became fluent in it and wrote The Word Hoard?
Well, I'd actually read Beowulf in high school, and I read it in translation, and I wasn't that keen on it at the time. I didn't think it was that interesting. But when I went to university, as a first-year university student, I went to a seminar about the different languages offered at my university, the different foreign languages offered at my university. And I was fascinated to discover that Old English was among the options of foreign languages. And it really surprised me that a language that I speak fluently could have a version of it that is foreign. So I took the class on Old English grammar, and I continued taking it. I took a class on Beowulf, where we read the entire text of Beowulf in a semester, sort of line by line going through it. And that could sound like torture to some people, but I loved it. I had a really excellent teacher who really brought the world of the poem to life. He was very good at talking about how the different word choices and the ways of describing things and the way of talking about things could tell us things about 10th century England. It made me connect literature and history in a way that I hadn't done before. And then I basically fell in love with it and just kept taking Old English classes the rest of my time at university.
Final question as we wrap up. You have a popular Twitter account, more than 26,000 followers for the account called at OE Word Hoard. OE for Old English, Word Hoard, HORD. What do you do with this Twitter account, and why do you think it's so popular?
I started this Twitter account back in 2013, kind of on a whim. I had recently done a public engagement project with some other postgraduates at King's College London, and we had made this physical word hoard. So we actually had a wall in a small gallery that we had people painting words on this wall we had. So we created this physical word hoard, which I thought was really neat. And I kind of wanted it to continue on after the project was done. And so I started a Twitter account where I just shared an old English word every day. The very first one being word hoard. And I didn't really think it would continue for as long as it has, or that that many people would be interested in it. But I guess people are really interested in learning about the language that they speak, maybe. So seeing the words that are very familiar or very different for English speakers. I know also there are people who follow who are fluent in languages like Dutch and German. And I think they're quite interested to see how similar some of those old English words are to them. And a lot of people have followed and seem to enjoy getting a dose of old English every day, which is great.
Hannah Vaideen, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about the poem Judith and the Old English Word Hoard.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've just listened to the Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to the Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at haymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is @haymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of the Great Books Podcast.